My friends at MyPillow, my buddy Mike Lindell, told me he was coming out with a brand new product. It's called the new mattress topper. So I got the new mattress topper immediately, and I've been sleeping on it now for a couple of months. It's the best thing you've ever felt in your life. Now, you literally have MyPillow foam for support. It's a transitional foam that helps relieve pressure points, and it's ultra-soft, patented temperature-regulating cover. And I got to tell you, it has a 10-year warranty, a cover that's washable and dryable. It's made in the USA, backed by their 60-day unconditional money-back guarantee. Once you try this new mattress topper, you put it right over your mattress, you will never sleep better. And right now, you, my radio listeners, you're going to save 30% off when you go to MyPillow.com and use the promo code TOPPER. And by the way, Mike will also give you two standard MyPillows absolutely free. All right, so try MyPillow.com, promo code TOPPER. Promo code TOPPER for this great deal and the best night's sleep you ever had. All right, glad you're with us. Sean Hannity Show. Write down our toll-free telephone number. You want to be a part of this extravaganza. It is a busy news day. 800-941-SEAN. If you want to join us, the best news is, in spite of whatever shenanigans went on in Florida and with an ongoing criminal investigation, I can hope that we get to the bottom of how this is happening almost now on a yearly election basis. That only two counties of the 67 in Florida, you know, that we have to be tortured this way. But Rick Scott is now officially the senator-elect of the great state of Florida. Ron DeSantis, the governor-elect, great state of Florida. Huge victory, huge win. Donald Trump went in there hard fighting for both of them. Obviously, his presence paid a big part in this, especially with the headwinds of midterm elections. She won't concede Stacey Abrams in Georgia, but Brian Kemp, as I said Friday, is the governor-elect of the great state of Georgia. We have some fascinating information on all of this. Brenda Snipes is out. I'll get to all of that. It is absolutely chilling and frightening to see what's going on out in California. I mean, it blows your mind to see the devastation. We now have confirmed 76 people that have been killed and 1,300 people remain missing out there. President made a trip over the weekend, talked a lot about better forestry. We're going to get to that in a second. That's part of the news that we're following in the course of the program today. We've got more Democratic chaos out there than you can shake a stick at. We have House Democrats ready to plunge the country back into a recession with a Green New Deal. Sounds like Solyndra on steroids. And they plan to run against America's systemic racism in 2020, according to the Politico. Well, that's pretty much been a playbook of the Democrats for years and years and years. But anyway, and I think also a masterstroke in terms of strategic political planning, the president is offering to help Nancy Pelosi to help save her speaker's job, offering as many Republican votes as may be needed to make that happen. I don't know who he's going to convince to do it. I couldn't do it if I was in there, but we'd head into a recession. So we have that. We have new news on both the caravan front, which we're going to get to, and problems that we're now seeing down at the border in Tijuana, and it's getting worse. We have a big problem that is emerging there. We expect at some point this week, this was a big win for the White House. Remember, we kept hearing about, well, they may subpoena the president and Robert Mueller, and there's going to be a constitutional showdown. Apparently, it didn't materialize into that, even through the process of Judge Kavanaugh, the elections, and everything else we've been following in recent weeks. And it's kind of taken our eye off the ball a little bit about the deep state. I haven't forgotten those people that really were involved in Russia collusion. And while we expect a report by Team Mueller and everybody's up in arms, oh, Whitaker's going to get rid of this guy, the temporary AG, that's not the case at all. And I also would expect at some point soon the president's going to put forward a new attorney general to be a full-time attorney general, and I have no idea who that might end up being, so we'll get to that. The president was pretty funny going after little shifty Adam Schiff, except change a couple of letters at the end. I thought that was hilarious. So that's sort of like the headlines. I want to start with the caravan. Well, let me start first with Florida, because we've been spending so much time on it, There is an ongoing criminal investigation. We'll get an update later from Pam Bondi on it. Here's the good news in all of this is now we've had Gillum and Nelson both do the right thing and concede something that has not happened in Georgia with Stacey Abrams in what was a bizarre interview that she had with Jake Tapper about not conceding. But that now brings where we are, 52 Republicans, 47 Democrats. Mississippi now is coming up, what, in about a week? How long is it? 10, whatever it is. They have a runoff election there. It should be a Republican hold. I assume Democrats will try and spend a lot of money there. This has been the year they'll spend whatever it takes to try and put Republicans in trouble. There are only three House races that remain undecided at this point. In Texas, Will Hurd has a 1,150-vote lead over Democrat Gina Ortiz Jones, who is contesting the results. Now, she can do that under state recall laws and call for a recount, but her campaign has to pay for it. I actually think that's fair. Democrat Carolyn Bordeaux is trailing Republican Bob Woodall. That's a Georgia race by fewer than 500 votes. Looks like Woodall got reelected there. I doubt there'll be a change in that race. And Bordeaux has yet to say whether she will seek a recount in that race. You know, we thought Mia Love was out of it in Utah, but she's up. And she's now ahead of the Democrat, Ben McAdams, by 419 votes in Utah. I wanted Mia to get her seat back, and I hope, in fact, that happens. But if we don't fix our elections, we have a lot of problems because every state has different laws. One of the things I don't like about early voting is, well, what happens if you can vote 3-4 weeks ahead of the election? And look, it's a good thing if you can vote by absentee, if you know you're not going to be available to vote that day. We want people to participate. But if you have an entire month to vote, to me, it just lends itself to more opportunities for things to go awry and for people to play games with the numbers. And if you have a month to vote, you're also whatever October surprise that might come out that possibly could have changed your mind, you're locked in already. Let's say you find out something horrible about the candidate you voted for. You can't go and say, can I have my ballot back? So the idea that people are voting further and further outside of the elections is problematic to me. I'm not saying the feds need to get in this and have one standard or one set of laws. But I do think both parties absolutely positively, they need monitors in every state, in every precinct, in every voting place, in every area where the votes are cast ahead of time, be it mail-in or absentee, they've got to be able to monitor them. And they've got to be able to follow where they go. And they've got to know that there are no opportunities for unscrupulous people to mess around with the vote. The vote in this country's got to be sacrosanct. And watching every year what happens in Broward County, I have no faith, hope, confidence at all that system is in any way working for the American people and the rest of Florida. Even the panhandle got the job done. The panhandle after, 27 days after one of the worst hurricanes. It was destroyed in some areas. Just devastation. So anyway, one bit of good news, Brenda Snipes made her exit this weekend. Do you know when they finally did the recount in Broward County, that Rick Scott picked up just shy of 800 more new votes. And by the time they uploaded the recount numbers, it didn't get to the Secretary of State's office in Florida till 4:02. Now, they were finished the recount at 3. And it benefited Scott to get those important votes. And those votes didn't count. Unbelievable. Anyway, Sun Sentinel said hours after finishing the election recount, Brenda Snipes submitted her resignation, ending a 15-year tenure full of botched elections, legal disputes, and blistering criticism. She sent it in, according to an attorney who works as a counsel for the Supervisor of Elections Office, Evelyn Perez Verdia, former office spokesperson who left several years ago, said Sunday that she was told by people in the office that the letter was sent to Tallahassee earlier in the day. And in the final version of the resignation letter sent to Governor Rick Scott, Snipes said it was in her passion and honor to have served the office. I'm ready to pass the torch. And Snipes has now been the subject of waves of criticism for long lines, slow vote counts. You know, how many laws is any one county in Florida allowed to ignore or just not pay attention to? How is it it's always the same two counties? So I don't know what the system is, but, you know, we know Broward County also misplaced over 2,000 votes. I mean, how do you misplace 2,000 votes? But it happened, and we'll see what happens there. These are huge wins. You know, everybody in the media, it was interesting how quickly the left and the media and the Democrats wanted to get off the topic of the elections, because Donald Trump has now done something that has now happened three times, only the third time in the last 100 years, and that is pick up these Senate seats that he fought so hard for and went out and campaigned on. I mean, if you looked at the polls, both Gillum and in the case of the Nelson, they were ahead in these polls going into Election Day. And Donald Trump, you know, skipped all around the state of Florida, and I guarantee you had a big impact. Also think he had a big impact in Tennessee and a big impact in Missouri and a big impact in North Dakota and a big impact in Indiana, because the headwinds of midterm elections are just what they are. And look at the two most recent Democrats as the best examples. Barack Obama, his first midterm, lost 6 Senate seats, 63 House seats. That was a blowout. Same with Bill Clinton. He lost 8 Senate seats. This is 94 and 52 House seats. So it's, you know, that's why the media is not talking about it. If it's success and it's for Trump, that's why they're not talking about it. It was fascinating to turn on TV this morning and watch what's happening now at the border with Tijuana, the U.S.-Mexico border down there. The Army has arrived along with the border. They're moving swiftly to block this incoming caravan, and they're laying miles of razor wire to steer thousands of these migrants from legal crossings when tent cities are to be erected. The problem is now, with more and more caravan people coming to the border, the people on these border cities on the Mexican side are livid. Now, this is the Washington Examiner. According to eyewitness reports, troops, trucks delivering construction equipment, portable bathrooms, security to several areas along the border. The first wave of the president's promise to bolster immigration enforcement with 5,000 or more new soldiers. But the new troops and equipment are coming with full force. Now, this morning what happened, we have outraged Mexican citizens in Tijuana that are literally taking to the streets, protesting the arrival of these caravans. NBC News reporting tensions rising Sunday as hundreds of residents protested the arrival of thousands of Central American migrants who are expected to linger in a border city for months as they try to claim asylum in the United States. One group opposed to the chaos and the migrants in Tijuana outside of a makeshift shelter. You have Mexican police there in riot gear forming a perimeter to protect the people there. Protesters had no problem with immigration, but are strongly opposed to what they call an illegal invasion. These are the people in Tijuana. These are people in Mexico making these words. Some protesters said the Mexican government should follow Trump's lead, adopt tougher border policies. Because what's happening is now we're getting to the point where thousands are arriving. An entire town is now beginning to have to deal with the fact that the Mexican government allowed them to get up to this point. But they're not going to be able to cross the border here. And I've been saying, you know, otherwise it's the invasion that you saw with the fences being knocked down and people just racing across in southern Mexico just a few weeks ago. All right, as we roll along, Sean Hannity Show, toll-free, telephone numbers 800-941-SEAN. So there was initial anger at Donald Trump when he tweeted out about the forest fires. It was in the early stages. I know because I live there. I lived in California. This is not a new problem for California. I had left Santa Barbara, an adjacent area was known as Hope Ranch in the Santa Ynez Mountains out there. Some of the most beautiful country you've ever seen. But and the president went out there. I mean, people have been ravaged. It's just you see home after home destroyed. Billions and billions and billions of dollars in damage. And the president rightly pointed out something that we have been pointing out is that good forestry has not been happening out in California. We have over 1,300 American citizens now missing as we speak. 76 now is where the current death total stands. And it was a great read in the Wall Street Journal, but one of the, you know, these fires killing all of these people and these hundreds of thousands of acres, if you look at about 57% of California forest land is owned by the federal government. Most is private land regulated by the state. There's nearly 130 million trees that are dead in California in a seven-year period between 2010 and 2017 because of drought, bark beetle infestation. And the more dense the forest put these trees at a greater risk, and they don't allow any type of logging. They don't even allow dead tree removal. And even when, you know, because of laws, Endangered Species Act, National Environmental Policy Act, it has hampered all tree clearing, controlled burns. That's also, nope, can't do that. That's a no-no. And all timber sales on federal land. And if you don't thin these forests out, this is what you get. It's not good. All right, 25 till the top of the hour, 800-941-SHAWN, toll-free telephone number. You want to be a part of the program. If you're just joining us, only three outstanding House races to be called. My buddy Rod Arquette at KNRS out in Salt Lake City says Mia Love is now up by 1,500 votes. Thanks, Rod. So it means that it looks like those three seats will go Republican, which is good. The margin of victory far less than obviously anything that happened to either Obama or Clinton, and both of them lost significant numbers of Senate seats. And we have the one runoff in Mississippi. We'll be giving you more information as the days come and go. That is going to be an important seat. Republicans get that. It's 53-47. That's a nice margin, especially when it comes to Supreme Court justices, a nice margin when it comes to a new AG, nice margin when it comes to dealing with whatever House shenanigans are sent over from them. But just back to what's happening out in California. I mean this with all my heart. Listen, I lived in California 5 years in Santa Barbara. I think I was the poorest person out there at the time. And it is one of the most beautiful places on earth. And it is, and you look to the mountains, you know, having grown up in Long Island, you don't have mountains like this. And it was majestic to me. It was just different. It's just beautiful. And you have the benefits of it being on the Pacific Ocean. I mean, it's all part of the Pacific Coast Highway that, you know, the 101 you'll take all the way from, you know, Northern California straight on down to Southern California with the most picturesque, stunning, spectacular views. If you ever want to take a trip and you don't mind driving, you know, you ought to take your family and drive it. Anyway, so it's a beautiful town. It has, along with other areas in California, Ventura's been through this, Malibu's been through this, Los Angeles has been through this, Northern California's been through this. We keep having all of these wildfires, this now becoming the worst of them in terms of just the death toll, the damage, and a great fear of what, you know, when you have 1,300 people missing, that's scary. And that number has been rising now very quickly every single day. And, you know, people got angry at the president about talking about forest management, but the president's right. You know, if you have 76 people dead, you have entire, this is not the first time these fires have hit California. And we got to start asking some really tough questions. And why do we ask the questions? So we can prevent tragedy from ever happening in the future. It shouldn't be a Republican versus Democrat issue. For some, they'll make it that. It shouldn't be a we care about the land and you want to rape and pillage the land for profit argument either. It should be, you know, a fundamental analysis If you're worried about air quality, look at the damage to the environment this fire is doing. And, you know, you're talking about hundreds of thousands of acres now that have been burned out here. And as the Wall Street Journal had said, there's no reason for the massive, deadly, costly forest fires in California, except forest management is so poor. And when the president tweeted out billions of dollars are given every year, and the billions are spent to prevent this these tragedies, and it's because there's gross mismanagement in terms of forestry. And then you get into some of the politics of it, which I wish we didn't have to get into. And the president went out there and pledged to the governor, Jerry Brown. Even Jerry Brown, by the way, admitted that Trump was right about California wildfires. Governor Brown appears to have quietly admitted that Trump's suggestion about improving California forestry was correct and is now urging state lawmakers to loosen restrictive logging regulations put in place to appease environmentalists. The Santa Cruz Sentinel has reported that Brown is now proposing one of the most significant changes to the state's logging rules in nearly half a century. And Governor Brown is now proposing broad new changes to California's logging rules that would allow landowners to cut larger trees and build temporary roads without obtaining a permit as a way to thin more forests across the state. Well, that's good for everybody because they're doing the work for you. You don't have to pay for it. And secondly, it obviously creates a safe barrier. There's got to be some areas in there. Now, apparently California environmentalists just aren't on board even yet. They've been pushing for years to make California's logging rules the most restrictive. And in the wake of these fires, you know, one's going to imagine that people's attitudes about this are going to change. But under Brown's proposal, private landowners would then be able to cut trees up to 36 inches in diameter, up to the current 26 inches up from there, on property 300 acres or less without getting timber harvest permits from the state. I mean, it's all about money, too, for the states. But here's what we know is that the president is right in what he's saying, and he was right, and he is right. And we know because it keeps happening. And we know because these laws, restrictive laws, have been in place forever in California. And when you have 57% of California forest land owned by the federal government, and they're spending billions to do these things, and even with the money there, they're not allowed to do these things, I think that creates this environment. When you have 130 million dead trees in California, you couple that with drought. By the way, that's just between 2010 and 2017. Some of it because of drought, some of it because of bark beetle infestation. You have a dense forest that puts trees at greater risk for some type of parasitic infection, enables fires to spread faster. When trees, dead trees fall, they add more combustible fuel. Now, there was a time when U.S. Forest Service, their mission was to actively manage the federal government's resources, yet numerous laws over the last 50 years, including the Endangered Species Act, National Environmental Policy Act, have all hampered tree clearing, controlled burns, and timber sales on federal land, and restricting even homeowners from cutting down a tree on their own property. I know on my own property, to get a tree cut down on my own property, for whatever reason. I'm by the way, I like all my trees. I don't want to cut them all down, but some need to be cut down. You got to get a permit to cut down a tree. It's ridiculous. And they also restrict timber harvesting. You need a myriad of permits, environmental impact statements to even prune what are overgrown forests. The state legislative analyst's office noted in April that project proponents seeking to conduct activities to improve the health of California's forests indicate that in some cases, state regulatory requirements can be excessively duplicative, meaning you have to do it again and again, lengthy and costly. The biggest problem for landowners is disposing of the dead wood. Maybe they want some firewood for cold nights. Anyway, and then they, of course, they're concerned about emissions. Well, I think if you look at the emissions from this burn, you might learn that there's going to be environmental damage if you let it go on and don't treat it. I mean, look, at some point you got to say, okay, controlled burns work better. We can save lives in people's homes. thinning out dead trees. That's a good start. You know, getting rid of kindling, underbrush, things that are likely to ignite more quickly. That's important also. I mean, you couple these fires with the heavy winds that might come in with Santa Ana, and you got yourself the disaster that we see now unfolding before our eyes. Thinning the forest could actually save Californians billions of gallons of water every year, according to an April study by the National Science Foundation. And the good news is the Trump administration is expanding timber sales on federal land, and this year's harvest is going to be the biggest in 20 years. So if you want to restore forest to good health, it may take years, but you got to learn what you've been doing here is just wrong. You know, it's mind-numbing to me that we find ourselves in this position. And no end in sight for this. I know that, and then it gets tougher. They're expecting rain. After the rain, then you're going to have even bigger problems. Then you have the potential of mudslides. Look, I don't have all the answers, but certain common sense measures, certainly control burns, certainly areas of thinning out the kindling in these fires, certainly barrier building where you don't want the fires to be able to jump from this portion of the forest to the next portion of the forest. You know, it's got to be handled now, or it's going to be one disaster after another. And I don't think anybody wants to see that. And the president, but look at this, Al-Qaeda is even saying they're now touting the California burning, saying, oh, this is just the beginning. But the president did commit to help the good people of California, albeit it's a liberal state, but they really deserve it. I mean, there's all these people have been wiped out. I'm not talking about the Hollywood actors and actresses in their multi-million dollar homes. I'm talking about, you know, the rank and file good people of California that work hard and play by the rules, and they're watching everything they built their entire lives just go up in smoke. It's heartbreaking to ever see anybody have to go through that. And it's terrible. You know, you got so many crazy things out in the way. I mean, one crazy thing after another. Get this. So this is where liberalism has gone. There's a school now in the United Kingdom. They've forbidden students from wearing any expensive jackets because doing so may poverty shame other students. You got to be kidding me. Linda, you're going to laugh. I didn't have a winter coat this year, you know, just a hangout jacket. So I stopped at TJ Maxx over the weekend.
Oh, yeah. I love TJ Maxx. What'd you get?
I just got a black coat, a winter coat, and I got a pair of gloves.
Oh, my God. You got a black coat? That's so original.
I know. So original with pockets.
Wonderful.
Like my Harley jacket, which I can't wear because it has no pockets.
You really are a weirdo. I'm going to get you that thing off TV. Have you seen that As Seen on TV
What's
jacket?
That?
It's for annoying people like you that want to shove everything in their pockets. And it has inside pockets on the inside lapels, and you can put whatever you want in there. That's what I'm going to get you for Christmas.
Oh, I didn't know you were buying me a Christmas. By the way, did
First
Linda
of all,
start
her, I buy you presents every year. Please do not act like you get nothing, Tiny Tim.
I don't even know. Is it going to be your Christmas party this year? I got an invitation to the Sean Hannity Show Christmas party. And no,
I don't know what you're talking about.
Nobody came to me and said, oh, are we doing a Christmas party again this year like usual? Not one person asked.
Listen, I know you don't like parties.
Okay, but we're having a Sean Hannity Show Christmas party. I did go last year. I did have a good time. I stayed much longer than I usually would because I was having fun. There were great people. Can I just ask a question? Did you really order like a great band for this party?
I ordered them. They'll be here. The shipping says 2 to 3 weeks.
I didn't say shipping, but they're going to be playing at the event?
Yes, they will be.
Okay. And this is your old band?
It is indeed.
Okay. So this is going to be an expensive night for the boss, right?
Well, I mean, it depends. Are you coming?
Of course I'm going to come to
this. Then it's going to be very expensive.
But it's not my party. This is your party. You put the party on. You pick the guest list.
You can host it with me.
How many people have you invited to this party?
Too many.
How many is too many?
Too many.
How many?
I can't talk about it on air. It's uncomfortable.
Is it over 100? 200?
It might be.
Think of all the guests she's going to get emails from right now. Let's just move on.
Yeah, you're making it very uncomfortable.
Oh, okay. So how many people did you put on the original list?
You know, we always start with a number and then we work backwards, right? It's kind of like you know, it's like when you're looking at who you're going to sit next to who at the wedding, and you realize it just doesn't work.
But
and you
stop the phony baloney Sean Hannity's Christmas party when it's not. It's the Linda McLaughlin Christmas party.
I'm just paying reverence.
No, the only thing is Sean Hannity just pays the bill of the party. Whatever you decide,
like
I'll pay for.
Tell us that the party's in your name, but she's throwing it.
The party's in my wallet. I'm paying for the party.
Shouldn't you be glad that it's not all in your wallet?
Wait a minute. I didn't even get asked. I only got an invitation. I didn't get asked, you know, do you like this person, that person? Who do you want to invite? I didn't even get asked one question about it.
Do you know how hard it would be for you to plan a party? Shouldn't you be thanking Linda for inviting and having all your friends show up for a Christmas party?
It is the season of thanks, Sean.
I think your band at its height was charging $30,000 an appearance. That's what I have
in my
head.
If my band at their height was charging $30,000 in appearances, I would not be here. Just so you know.
They were charging at least 10.
They may have.
Great. Is it in a fun place, or is it going to be like I have to put on a jacket place?
I'm just going to hold it in the public square.
You're going to invite everybody?
Everybody. It's a BYO whatever.
Maybe we'll do what Rachel Maddow does over, you know, whenever the resistance. We'll tell the resistance where the party is.
I would never tell the resistance where anything is.
Then they can show up.
Except the IRS so they could learn how to pay taxes for once in their life.
All right, a lot coming up. Could this fire tragedy. Everyone's now looking at the veto of the wildfire bill that Jerry Brown vetoed in 2016. You know, the measure would have required the state and their utility commission to work with municipalities to ensure energy companies do all they can to prevent what happened here. And he vetoed that bill. Also, it included a lot of other issues that we've been just discussing. All right, the latest out of Florida, the caravan, the fire in California, much more straight ahead. All right, hour two, Sean Hannity Show, 800-941-SEAN, if you want to be a part of the program. Amazing what has happened this weekend as we're now watching. It started out with 80 people and part of this caravan, and the estimates vary quite dramatically, but it's kind of now coalesced around the number 11,000, and the information I'm reading as high as 14,000-15,000, as low as 6,000 or 7,000. And then the next wave of 1,000 people have gotten to the border of Tijuana. And amongst the shouting is Trump was right. This is an invasion.
And we did like a protesting against the Central America people and just to come down because we feel unsafe. Mm-hmm. And so we want our neighborhood to come back to normal again.
They are coming. They are gangs. They are bad people.
Our government has not taken control of these, what we call invasions. If you live in a house, you have walls, you have doors, you have gates. And so we do that because we don't want to let just anybody go into our house. And I consider this country my house on a larger scale. And we should control our borders.
Lo que dijo Donald Trump es verdad. Es una invasión.
I saw it on Fox and Friends this morning. So you have the citizens in Tijuana now being outraged and literally taking to the streets protesting the arrival of thousands of illegal caravan border crashers. And the protesters are complaining that the caravans are loaded with violent gang members, and they're shouting, quote, Trump was right, this is an invasion. And that's according to NBC News. And tensions rose on Sunday, yesterday, as hundreds of residents protested the arrival of thousands of Central American migrants who are expected to linger at the border city now for months as they try to claim asylum in the U.S. A group opposed to the, quote, chaos of the so-called caravans protesting outside the makeshift shelter as now local police in Tijuana are in riot gear and having formed a perimeter, and demonstrators were singing the Mexican national anthem and waving flags as they urged the migrants to go home. Protesters said they had no problem with legal immigration, but they're strongly opposed to what they called an illegal invasion. Anyway, here to make sense out of what's going on at the border now is Geraldo Rivera, author of The Geraldo Show and host of his own show podcast, and Marie Salazar, candidate for Congress, Florida, in their 27th district. And welcome both of you to the program.
Hey, Sean.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
You know, it's interesting because, you know, if we go back to when the caravan first crashed, knocked down the fences and charged into Mexico, Geraldo, you go back to that moment. I said, when you have that many people, you have to prepare. This president is not going to let them in. He's been clear. The vice president's been clear. We're now building barriers with these barbed, you know, razor wires in areas where we believe people might be trying to cross. We see now that the town of Tijuana is overwhelmed and inundated with people from the caravan. And, you know, feeling the same way that many Americans feel, that you got to come, if you want to come into Mexico, you got to come in legally. Like, we want the American borders respected, the Mexican border should be respected. And it seems like this is going to spiral out of control probably pretty fast, as I've sadly been predicting and hoping to be wrong on.
Well, if you're asking me, Sean, I think that what we have to do is layered, and I'll be very brief about it. I think first, we've got to spend a considerable amount of resources to get the word out in Central America that unauthorized migrants are not welcome, and they will not be permitted to claim asylum. And by TV time, by radio time, by ads in the newspapers, counter the notion that has been spread by the public interest groups, the lobby groups, the organizers, Pueblos Sin Fronteras, Citizens Without Frontiers, all that. We've got to counter the notion that if you get to the border, you're in. I think that that is a PR mission. Secondly, we've got to recognize who these people are. Forget about the MS-13 and the gangbanger. I don't think that that is the significant story, because the gangbangers, the professional criminals, will find a way in, and they don't need a caravan to sneak in. They've been doing it for decades. They'll continue to do it. The trial of El Chapo, who dug a mile-long tunnel, and I did that a report on your show, shows that the pros can get in. It's the desperately poor people. We've got to recognize we've got some of the poorest people on earth living next door to some of the richest people on earth. I think we've got to have an immigration reform program. The President Trump is ideally suited now to dare the Democrats and get something going where you give the Dreamers a pathway to citizenship, you take care of the wall, you build the damn wall, which I think will relieve the psyche of many Americans fearful of this flood, and you make a deal where you have temporary work visas so these people can be flown in to do the harvest the way they used to be, then flown home again, vastly increase the temporary crossings, authorize temporary crossings, recognize the special relationship between Central America and Mexico and the United States. And I think that's the beginning, Sean.
And what's your take, Maria Salazar? What do you think?
Well, I agree with what Mr. Rivera is saying. And I do believe when he said go and send the message to the Central Americans, I would go a step further. I have been saying during my campaign to President Trump that I believe that what he needs to do is to call for an emergency summit meeting in Tegucigalpa, the capital of Honduras, with the Salvadorian president, with the Honduran president, and with the Guatemalan president. And President Trump is the master of the art of the deal. And I'm sure the same way he did it with Kim Jong-un in Singapore, he can do it in Tegucigalpa. And what would he be telling them? In which way I can help you keep your boys home or your people home? You know, I was Central American bureau chief for Univision for many years. I covered the war. I know them very well. And they really respect and want the American hand to help them. We have a major problem. We have a high homicide rate in Honduras, in Guatemala, and El Salvador. And the only way we can prevent from this happening again, because we're concentrated now, Sean, on what's happening now, the 10,000 and the 5,000 and the other 1,000. This is going to keep on happening.
Well, especially if word doesn't get out. And the problem is that if you're seeking asylum from a Central American country and the first country you arrive in is Mexico, that's where the asylum application belongs, not in the United States. You know, DHS officials today, Geraldo, this is what they've identified, our worst fear. Not that the vast majority of people in the caravan don't want the great life that we all, you know, will acknowledge on Thanksgiving this week that we take for granted too often. But they've also, quote, identified more than 500 criminals traveling with the caravan flow. Now, in a conference call with reporters, our own DHS officials asserted that most of the caravan members are not women and children, Rather,
yeah,
they're saying that the caravan is mostly single, adult or teen males that have been and have placed the women and children in the front of the line in order to gain sympathetic coverage. This is from DHS. They've also said there are about 6,000 now people waiting to be processed at the San Ysidro border, crossing near Tijuana, not all of them from the caravan, and another 16 or so Mexicali with 8,500 to 10,500 in total waiting to be processed. We can't, we don't have the, we can't even get Americans through an airport, Geraldo.
Yeah, but that it's, that's what has been happening for years. This is nothing new. Is now they are together at 10,000, but we have 400, 500 people trying to get in being caught every day. So what we're saying is that this is more of the same. We should nip it at the bud. How do you nip it at the bud and make it something that will go away forever?
Build the
immigration
wall.
Reform law. Reform
the build
law.
The wall. If the wall's there, you can't get over the wall.
The
if
wall
you put in
will
this...
be okay. The wall will be helpful for the non-criminal, the typical person coming for economic reasons. I think backing up. Let me just reiterate something that Marie and I agree on: the fact that they are coming to plead asylum. We have to let them know in our massive public relations campaign that they will not be granted asylum, that they do not qualify for asylum, that their trip is therefore based on a faulty premise. Don't come, you're not going to get asylum. Now, how do you handle those who claim asylum at the border when you have this vast flood of people? You've sent the military to the border. I am opposed to that. I didn't like it when George W. Bush did it. I didn't like it when Barack Obama did it. I don't think it's effective. But what you can do...
I'll tell you why it's effective. They're not going to be involved in the law enforcement aspect of it, but they're laying down a lot of barbed wire and razor wire so that they can't cross it or charge it the way they did in southern Mexico.
Surge immigration judges get hundreds of judges to the border courts, vastly expand the temporary courts, accelerate the pace of asylum hearings, let people see that the asylum ruse is not going to work. We are enormously sympathetic. These are hungry, hardworking people, and I reject, from what I can see, the claim that there are 500 criminals among 5,000 immigrants.
We've had Mexican officials, and now this was an update. It was 300. Now they're saying they've identified 500. Among 10,000 to 11,000, I'm sure the rest of the people are what I said they are. Hardworking people that live in poverty that want the American dream. Maria.
But then what I'm saying to you is, what about those girls that are being raped or being threatened to be raped by the gangs, the MS-13 in Honduras? What are you going to do? You got to give them due process of law, and chances are...
How do you give 10,000 and then another 20,000 and then another 30,000 people, you know, full and complete due process? I mean... They're going to come in and they're going to, if they find out a particular story is one that would work with officials, isn't that going to get repeated over and over again?
Well, that is absolutely. And that's what we're facing right now.
But we don't have the capacity to vet any of that information.
We haven't had the capacity for years. Look at our asylum system. It's collapsing. You have for you to be able to get asylum or yes or no, it's 6 years. So in the meantime, you're in the United States with a work permit because you're under the asylum protection. We got to stop that as well. But at the same time,
if you accelerate the number of judges, that will help mitigate that problem. But listen to what I'm saying. As long as you have the poorest people on earth living next door to the richest people on earth, you're going to have a natural movement between poverty and wealth. That is inevitable. What you have to do, aside from the PR campaign that says you're not going to get asylum, you've got to help correct some of the social conditions.
Wait a second.
Let me finish. You've got to help correct some of the social conditions in Central America that you're complaining about.
Geraldo, just slow down. We have now been in the process, in 2 years Donald Trump's been president, we have now been in the process of reversing the economic damage and the poverty in our own country. Obama added 13 million more Americans to the food stamp rolls, put 8 million more Americans in poverty. We now have 4.3 million fewer Americans on food stamps, 8 million fewer Americans in poverty since the president has been, and 4.5 million new jobs created. But we're not done fixing this country. We still have plenty of poverty in big towns and small cities all across this country, and we're not addressing them either.
And you are absolutely correct. So then what do you do with the situation we have right now?
We have to get our own house in order first, build the wall so that nobody can get hurt on either side. It's for the protection of everybody. And in the interim, develop a system whereby needs and certain vetting procedures are implemented, coupled with some type of proof and evidence that you can take care of yourself if you are one of the lucky ones that gets through to come to America and have a shot at the American dream.
All good, all good. But the bitter,
are you proud of me?
Bitter,
see,
the bittersweet.
You're so proud of me.
The bitterness of this is we have virtual full employment in the United States. We have fruits and vegetables that are going unharvested because there is insufficient labor in the agricultural sector of our economy almost throughout the country.
For those people that apply legally, let them in, but after you vet them, and once we assure the American people that they have a place to work and sustain and take care of themselves.
Yeah, but you are not thinking about the economic side. I'm talking about the asylum side, which is the one that you were talking about.
How do you possibly prove? Every person will learn to claim the most outrageous case of oppression. How does America possibly verify or corroborate tens of thousands of stories, probably one more horrific than the next?
President Trump has made clear that he will not, he's ordered the judges not to consider economic plight as a reason for asylum. There has to be a specific, credible threat.
All right, we have to see how it works. Build the wall first, and then we get to make all those decisions from a position of strength and a position where we can insist on background checks and vetting and also insist that people have the means to take care of themselves, and it won't be the American taxpayer that, in fact, has to foot the bill. It's more complicated than people say. Thank you both, though. 800-941-SEAN, toll-free telephone number. You want to be a part of the program. We'll hit the phones next. Next hour, we have Pam Bondi, the Attorney General. Yeah, it is now done. Rick Scott, Senator-elect from the great state of Florida, Ron DeSantis, Governor-elect, great state of Florida, and yes, Brian Kemp, the Governor-elect in Georgia. A lot of anger. Only three races remaining in terms of what we're looking for outcome. We'll have that. We have an amazing Hannity tonight. I'll tell you about that, 9 Eastern on the Fox News Channel, and much more.
I acknowledge that former Secretary of State Brian Kemp will be certified as the victor in the 2018 gubernatorial election. But to watch an elected official who claims to represent the people in this state baldly pin his hopes for election on the suppression of the people's democratic right to vote has been truly appalling. So let's be clear. This is not a speech of concession. Because concession means to acknowledge an action is right, true, or proper. As a woman of conscience and faith, I cannot concede that. But my assessment is the law currently allows no further viable remedy. As I have for more than 25 years, I will stand with my fellow Georgians in pursuit of fairness. You see, I did so as a college student, speaking in the shadow of Abraham Lincoln and Martin Luther King Jr. at the 30th anniversary of the March on Washington. I did so as Democratic leader of the House of Representatives and as the Democratic nominee for governor of Georgia. And now I will do so as a private citizen, ready to continue to defend those whose choices were denied full expression. Today, I announce the launch of Fair Fight Georgia, an operation that will pursue accountability in Georgia's elections and integrity in the process of maintaining our voting rolls. In the coming days, we will be filing a major federal lawsuit against the state of Georgia for the gross mismanagement of this election and to protect future elections from unconstitutional actions.
Is he the legitimate governor-elect of Georgia?
He is the person who won an adequate number of votes the governor of Georgia.
With all due respect, and I respect where you're coming from, and I respect the issues that you're raising, you're not answering the question. Do you think you're not using the word legitimate. Is he the legitimate governor-elect of Georgia?
He is the legal governor of Georgia. And here's the thing, Jake. I want to be very clear. Words have meaning. And I've spent my lifetime not only as an attorney but as a writer. And I'm very careful with the words I choose. And yes, when he takes the oath of office, he will be the legal governor of the state of Georgia. He is the legal victor. But what you are looking for me to say is that there was no compromise of our democracy and that there should be some political compromise in the language I use. And that's not right. What's not right is saying that something was done properly when it was not. I will never deny the legal permature that says that he is in this position. And I pray for his success. But will I say that this election was not tainted, was not a disinvestment and a disenfranchisement of thousands of voters? I will not say that.
But we wanted to interrupt a little bit of our break to first thank everybody who helped us along this journey as we worked incredibly hard, not only to win an election, quite frankly, but to build and strengthen a movement for everyday people again here in the state of Florida. We said that we will fight until the last vote is counted. Obviously, we are now closing out the hand recount phase in two of the statewide races. We wanted to make sure that every single vote, including those that were overvotes, undervotes, as long as it was a legally cast vote, we wanted those votes to be counted. And now that we are rounding that process out, RJ and I wanted to take a moment to congratulate Mr. DeSantis on becoming the next governor of the great state of Florida.
All right, there we have the fallout from the election. Stacey Abrams, I mean, getting into a word game in that interview with Jake Tapper, conceding that Brian Kemp is the governor, and then talking about, but this is not a concession speech. Are you conceding or not? Do you have any evidence to back up anything of which you are claiming? And the answer is no. And it just, I never think that works out well in the long run for people that come off as sore losers, tight race, whatever it happens to be. But they never got the numbers that they needed. And that's just the way it is and what it comes down to. Thank God that Brenda Snipes over the weekend has decided to get out and resign. You know, the Broward County election supervisor, she made her exit this weekend as the dust settled on the Florida recount fiasco. I think there's got to be follow-up far beyond. Where did these 100,000 votes come from? Why are certain counties, two basically in Florida of 67 counties, why are two not abiding by Florida law and the Florida Constitution? Why do two counties get to hold up for the rest of the state, the results of that state? And was there any nefarious activities going on by people? I'd like to know the answer to that question, if, as an investigation, I'm sure is still ongoing. But we now have Senator-elect Nelson of Florida and Governor-elect Ron DeSantis of Florida. Those are two massive, huge wins for the Republicans. It's massive. And that now brings the Republican count in the Senate to 52. Democrats 47, and then we have the Mississippi runoff that is coming. We'll talk more about that in the days ahead. In that race where the Republican is expected to pick up that seat, there are only three House races now that are not decided. All three of them look good for the Republican candidate, and that would bring their number to 202, and that would be Congressman Will Hurd, Representative Will Hurd. He has 1,150 vote lead over the Democrat Jones that he's facing and who's just contesting the results under state law. Well, in this case, Gina Ortiz Jones can contest a call for a recount, but her campaign's going to have to foot the bill for it. You have Democrat Carolyn Bordeaux trailing Republican Bob Woodall by fewer than 500 votes in their Georgia districts. Looks like Woodall is going back to Congress and the election is yet to be certified. But Bordeaux has said she will also seek a recount. Mia Love, in what has been a really tight race in the state of Utah, she is ahead of the Democrat Ben McAdams by 419 votes in Utah, where many provisional ballots apparently are still being counted. How do you still count them, you know, all these weeks later? I mean, there's no confidence. You cannot have confidence in this system if this is what happens. So it looks like, in the end, Republicans, Donald Trump's campaigning and his victories in Florida and Indiana and North Dakota and Missouri, where he pushed the hardest, and Tennessee, have paid off extraordinarily well, because he's only the third president in 100 years to pick up seats in the Senate in his first midterm. I watched the media, and the media hasn't talked about being so wrong on their blue wave prediction. It's a ripple, if you want to call it anything. The House was very tight. Republicans retired 40-some-odd people, but it was nowhere near the massacres of the years that Bill Clinton had and Barack Obama had. Bill Clinton lost 8 Senate seats in his first midterm. 8. Donald Trump picked up a few Senate seats. He lost 8, and then he lost 52 House seats. And that was a record at the time. Hadn't happened in decades and decades. Then Obama shattered that record, having lost 6 seats in the Senate in his first midterm in 2010, and then also losing 63 House seats. That's 69. So if you're looking at it on a historical basis, this is, I said this before the election. I said, you're facing historical headwinds that usually tend to bear out. And if you remember my predictions that I said, yeah, Republicans will pick up seats in the Senate. And I said, they're behind in the House. And that was based on a lot of different factors, reading all the polling that we read every day, looking at history, knowing that there was going to be a lot of resistant play out there. In other words, those people that hate Trump, and where they're picking up seats are interesting. I warned heavily about Southern California, and that turned out to be a wipeout of the 6 seats that I said, if there's any chance Republicans are going to go hold the House, they'd have to pick up all of them. They lost them all. And California is just voting terms and demographics has shifted very, very hard blue. All right, let's get to our busy telephones. A lot to talk about. We got the Acosta ruling. We got the California wildfires, how to prevent this from ever happening. You've got people in Tijuana, Mexico, saying that this is an invasion that they are going through and that Donald Trump is right. Pretty fascinating to watch this. Democratic chaos and everything else. You expect, too, we're going to be getting back into the deep state issues as the week unfolds. We say hi to Bill is in Ohio. Bill, hi. How are you? Welcome to the Sean Hannity Show.
Good. Thanks for taking my call. Hey, I find this decision on Acosta to be extremely disturbing and just a total violation of separation of powers. It essentially means that if you have a press pass, that it's a lifetime appointment to pass. It can never be taken away from you unless you violate some White House rule. And then, of course, if you violate a rule, if you have due process and you have a right to a hearing on whether they correctly revoke your pass even then. And it's just getting to the point where you feel like, why doesn't this federal judge just come to the press conferences and tell President Trump who he has to call on and how many questions they can ask?
Well, that's it. Look, that's obviously now what's happening. He got a strongly worded letter this weekend, and they are going to pull his pass again, and they are putting together standards and practices. But what they were saying, and I think arguing very effectively, is saying that, hey, we never thought we'd have to do it. But if we have to put the standards that the judge in this case is putting forward and give you due process, hi, here's your due process. You're put on notice. Here's where you went wrong. It's meant for one question only. When the president asks that you relinquish the microphone or somebody else working there asks that you relinquish the microphone, you do it. The fascinating thing is behind the scenes, all of Jim Acosta's so-called colleagues, that while they may be standing up on principle that they want him to stay, although, as the judge said, it wasn't a First Amendment issue, more of a Fifth Amendment issue, then they're sick and tired of him hogging the mic and putting on a show and making it all about him. They're tired of it because their access then to the president gets limited. What's that?
If President Trump issued an executive order that said every federal judge must hold a press conference once a week, you'd be amazed at how quickly the judiciary would suddenly rediscover separation of powers. And it's just a constant interference where it seems that every one of 1,000 federal judges thinks they can overrule the president of the United States anytime they disagree with something the president does. We saw that in the travel ban, where basically 32 federal judges were ultimately overruled by the Supreme Court. But in the meantime, they dragged out the travel ban process for about a year or so. Same thing with DACA. If federal judges had not interfered, it may have forced Congress to sit down and find a solution, and we wouldn't still be dealing with this problem. And it's just nonstop interference and lack of respect for the executive branch of government.
Yeah. Well, if they had it, it wouldn't be an issue. Good point. And thanks for the call. And by the way, CNN has reporters there. They've not been banned. The other reporters have not been banned. And so the court decision talks about setting up rules and standards. And the president mentioned in his interview with Chris Wallace, we're going to do that. We're writing him up right now. It's not that big a deal. If he misbehaves, we'll throw him out and we'll stop the news conference. And when pressed on the details, he said, well, we're going to have rules of decorum. You know, you can't keep asking questions. We have a lot of reporters in the room, many reporters in the room that are unable to ask questions because this guy gets up and starts doing what he's supposed to be doing for him and CNN, and that's shouting questions and making statements. I'll say this. Nobody believes in the First Amendment more than I do. And if I think if somebody's acting out of sorts, well, I'll just leave and say thank you very much. He doesn't have to take a single, not one. He doesn't have to take a single question from anybody. The other thing, too, is if everyone is getting equal treatment and they set up new standards, which they would have the right to do, maybe they'll throw him in the old executive office building across the street, and maybe that'll be the result. And I wonder then how Jim Acosta's colleagues would feel at that point if he insists on continuing this, you know, I'm giving a statement, I disagree, I want to have a fight, I want my moment on TV, this is, you know, all about me, I number one, oh my, my, what I think, what I know, what I love, what I like, what I see, you know, that's what he wants. He's looking for his moment. As we head back to our busy phones, Rod is in California. Rod, hi, how are you? Glad you called, sir.
I want to talk about this clown, Michael Avenatti. And, you know, he got arrested last week for alleged domestic violence. But what I thought was really rich was when he came out and did his impromptu news conference that he was a champion of women. He's never hit a woman. And that may be true. But if he's a champion for women, why is he $1.1 million behind on spousal support and child support for his first wife?
Listen, I don't know the specifics of his case. Let me just give you a broader answer, because I know he's had issues in his office and I guess whatever, he got thrown out of his office. I don't wish anybody ill here in any way. I don't know what happened with Michael Avenatti and the person that's making these allegations. I don't know. But I think maybe he might have a different perspective, because he went out with 100% certainty with a story that was just never met any smell test, having clearly not done any investigative work. His own client gives an affidavit. He files this affidavit in the case as relates to Judge Kavanaugh. She contradicts many key parts of a story, and that story shifts. That shouldn't happen. 800-941-SHAWN, toll-free telephone number. Quick break. We'll come back on the other side, and we will be checking in with Florida Attorney General Pam Bondi. A lot more of your calls, the great Chuck Liddell, and much more.
We had a margin on election night. It was a close race, but it was definitive that I had won. And even with some of the votes that turned up in Broward, I mean, my margin was significant enough. We knew the machine recount was not going to change it, and it didn't. And I also had confidence that Governor Scott would end up winning the recount, both the manual and machine recount there. So I think that's great that it happened and that we're moving on now. Obviously, we're going to have to address some of the problems with the election administration in places like Broward and Palm Beach County. I think it's good that Brenda Snipes has submitted her resignation. There was no way as governor that I was going to let her preside over another election down there after all the problems that they had. So we had 65 counties do a good job. We had two that dropped the ball. We want to make sure all 67 counties mm-hmm. do these elections in a fair way.
What happens next? You'll appoint someone to take over for Dr. Snipes?
It depends on when her resignation is effective. I heard it was going to be effective sometime in early January, mm-hmm. about the time I'm being sworn in. So, yeah, then that'll fall to me to appoint her replacement. If she has resigned immediately, then Governor Scott would have a window to appoint it before he leaves office.
All right, that was Ron DeSantis. Glad you're with us. News Roundup and Information Overload Hour, 800-941-SHAWN, toll-free telephone number. I have more sound of well, now Senate-elect Governor Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis talking about now that they have been declared the winners in the state of Florida. I will tell you, if we don't get a grip on those two counties in particular and Florida's voting system, we'll go through this every year. Brenda Snipes or no Brenda Snipes, it's going to keep happening. And I'm sure the people of Florida, you know, the judge in this case said it's making Florida a state, their elections, and a national embarrassment. I don't go that far. I'd say 65 counties are great. It's only two counties that are playing these games. And how do you find 100,000 votes? Anyway, Rick Scott and Ron DeSantis. This is what they said.
You know, we had a margin on election night. It was a close race, but it was definitive that I had won. And even with some of the votes that were that turned up in Broward, I mean, my margin was significant enough. We knew the machine recount was not going to change it, and it didn't. And I also had confidence that Governor Scott would end up winning the recount, both the manual and machine recount there. So I think that's great that it happened and that we're moving on now. Obviously, we're going to have to address some of the problems with the election administration in places like Broward and Palm Beach County. I think it's good that Brenda Snipes has submitted her resignation. There was no way as governor that I was going to let her preside over another election down there after all the problems that they had. So we had 65 counties do a good job. We had two that dropped the ball. We want to make sure all 67 counties mm-hmm. do these elections in a fair way.
What happens next? You'll appoint someone to take over for Dr. Snipes?
It depends on when her resignation is effective. I heard it was going to be effective sometime in early January, mm-hmm. about the time I'm being sworn in. So, yeah, then that'll fall to me to appoint her replacement. If she has resigned immediately, then Governor Scott would have a window to appoint it before he leaves office.
So I look forward to working with the president to get good things done for our state. And I'm just excited. I'm excited about being up there because I've learned a lot as governor. I've learned that if you start looking at how do you get a return on every dollar spent, a lot of good things can happen. The things that are important to me is we've got to keep this economy going. We've added 1.6 million jobs in Florida. We've got to keep this economy going. We've got to have a strong military. So I want to continue to focus on the military. I had the opportunity to serve in the Navy, my dad in the Army. So I want to continue to make sure we have a strong military. But the biggest thing is we got to keep this economy going. We got to watch how our money is spent, and we got to help our military. Those are big things for me.
All right, joining us now is the Attorney General of the great state of Florida. Pam Bondi is with us. Well, it took a while, and we had over 100,000 votes, quote, discovered after Election Day. All those votes should have been reported, as according to Florida law, within 30 minutes of the polls closing on Election Day. And I, in my heart, wonder, where do they all come from? Are we ever going to be able to figure that out?
Good afternoon, Sean. And yes, as you know, Florida has a pending criminal investigation. We're doing it hand in hand with our law enforcement partners throughout the state of Florida. And again, the election is over, but if anyone has evidence of any type of fraud, they could please call the Department of State because they have a dedicated hotline that's open. And if they could call that in, the number is 877-868-3737, 877-868-3737. To assure everyone, this is an ongoing and active criminal investigation. That's all I can say, but that will continue.
When you think through the prism of it's been 18 years since dimpled, pimpled, swinging, hanging, dented chads. In other words, scattered, smothered, and covered. I mean, it's funny on the one hand. On the other hand, it's not. It seems if you go to 2000, 2004, 2012, 2014, 15, 16, 17, and 18, you either have incidents or you have rulings by judges about how laws aren't followed and the Constitution ignored in Florida. Do you think the system itself is designed as a good system, seems to work in 65 counties, or does the whole thing need to be redesigned?
Well, I think you just hit the nail on the head. I mean, it works in 65 of the 67 counties. The problem seems to be reoccurring in certain counties throughout our state of almost 22 million people, as you know. And I don't know why most counties can get it right, and a couple never can. And that's why there is an investigation that I won't get into the details of that. But, I find it very interesting, and that's why we're going to go back and look at other elections as well as to see if there is a systematic pattern of something more than just negligence or incompetence or malfeasance to see if there is anything criminal there. And that's going to continue. But, you know, signature verification, I find it very interesting that Andrew Gillum was saying that he wants a fair election and it has to be ethical and have integrity, yet he doesn't want signature verification. And that's a joke, because without signature verification, you know what that means. Anybody could walk in and sign Sean Hannity and their vote would count. And so without signature verification, that's absurd. That is one of the safeguards in our system, and it has been working.
And by the way, that's a lot of work, because every ballot that is mailed in has to match the signature on the rolls, and if they're distinctly different, they get put aside, correct?
Correct. And there has to be accountability there, especially in a state as large as ours. And you know, when you find missing ballot boxes, well, I really don't want to get into more of the criminal part, but let me tell you, on the civil side, we firmly believe that our signature verification method is constitutional. Clearly, it's constitutional. The legislature drafted great law there, and that's what we hope to have continue in our great state.
Well, it sounds like you guys are finally getting a handle on it, and I think for the sake going forward, especially the importance of the 2020 elections, I hope Florida is able to fix, especially in these two counties. Are there not monitors at every polling place for both sides, the Democrats, Republicans, all parties? Do we not have monitors everywhere?
Yes, and as you knew, well, one of the issues that's been very public with the monitors was, you know, some campaigns weren't allowed to have monitors in the rooms, and they were told there wasn't enough room, there wasn't enough space. One county was reported that they were telling them that they could watch it, but they couldn't hear what was going on in the room, which was completely absurd. So after much litigation and much frustration by lawyers on the governor's side, I think all the cabinet members' side, and of course Rick Scott's side, both parties did have, the bottom line is both parties did have plenty of representation in the rooms and where they could hear, and this was during the recount, of course, as well, where they could hear what was happening when they're doing this manual recount and what they're looking at and how they're making this determination, especially the provisional ballots.
All right, Pam Pondy, we'll follow the story, hopefully get to the end of it. Thank goodness in this case, at least the people that truly won and had won by wider margins, hopefully we can find the reason for the discrepancy from Election Day. What now? Here we are, 2 weeks later? It's insane.
Right.
Thanks so
That's
much for
right.
being with us. All right, 800-941-SHAWN, toll-free telephone number if you want to be a part of the program. Let's say hi to Terry is in Lake City, Florida. Terry, hi, how are you? We're glad you called.
Yes, sir. I want to know if anybody, I've been listening to you for the past 2 years when you and your team exposed everything. If anybody on the Democratic side or on the left is ever going to be held accountable. I'm being patient. It seems like we're the Republicans and President Trump and everybody's doing everything right and we're following the rules, but it just seems like the left is just continuously getting away with everything.
You know, I don't disagree, and it is that way. I mean, you do have a grand total of 25 high-ranking DOJ, FBI officials that have either quit under a cloud of scandal, been demoted or been fired. And you're raising a great question because Trump says the written responses to Mueller, we expect to go out this week. I guess it can go out any day now, if not today or tomorrow. That would be before Thanksgiving. The good news is that clearly the Mueller team didn't feel the need to get into anything about, quote, obstruction, because the president had the right to fire anybody he wanted for any reason. That never was an issue. But you're right. They never got to the heart or the bottom of anything Russia, except that, we'd known this. And Devin Nunes had warned in 2014 that, yeah, they want to meddle in American elections. Good news is one report after another says it didn't impact the outcome. But, what's the main question they have? Did you collude with the Russians? No. Did anybody you know? No. Did you know that there was going to be this WikiLeaks dump? No. Okay, and that's pretty much the end of the questioning. There never was anything there. And what's so frustrating to me and to so many others is they let Hillary Clinton, who did violate the Espionage Act, go free because they wanted her to be politically viable. And then she came up with this phony dossier that she paid for, funneling money through a law firm to an op research group, to an MI6 guy, who eventually wouldn't even stand up for his own dossier and his own piece and op research, even though it was disseminated as truth to the American people before that election and just to hurt Donald Trump. and then used to bludgeon him and delegitimize him since he's been president for 2 years without any evidence. And so the question is, if they really cared about collusion and they don't, then we'd start with Hillary and her email server. And the only person that said it recently that I think is serious is Lindsey Graham. Now, to me, I think if we don't fix it and we allow these things to happen and the abuse of the powerful tools of intelligence and power this way, let me tell you what happens to America. We lose our constitutional republic. If you have one set of rules for one group of people and another set for another group of people, if you're going to dig down deep into the, you know, years gone by loan applications and put people in jail for that and let these people go free, we don't have justice in America. I hope that answers your question. 800-941-SEAN is our number if you want to be a part of the program. Story we're following, Chicago Tribune now reporting multiple people, including a police officer and shooter, wounded in an active shooter attack apparently ongoing at Mercy Hospital. This is in Chicago. And a police officer, multiple other people, including an apparent shooter, wounded in an active shooter attack, Mercy Hospital, North Side. It has brought out a large police presence late this afternoon. The officer was critically injured in the shooting earlier this afternoon. We're just finding out about it now, as apparently still ongoing. He's in critical condition, getting in excellent care. Reports of multiple victims in the attack. No reason why, given at this particular point in time, officers are now doing a methodical search. At least one possible offender is shot, and fire officials and other emergency medical personnel were brought in. 15 ambulances on the scene because of the active shooter situation. So a hospital employee said she was in her office when a notice came over the public address system in the hospital telling those in the hospital to lock their doors. They were later evacuated. And people were put on buses and authorities beginning to deal with the situation. Apparently, they had some protocol that they had built in the beginning. Part of it is notify Chicago, please avoid the area of Mercy Hospital. And now we have one officer in critical condition needing everybody's prayers today. Sad. Another shooting in Chicago. At one point in Chicago, are we ever going to address the magnitude of shootings that go on in this city that go unresolved? And it's almost like on a weekly, weekday basis. It's happening all the time. So we'll update that story throughout the rest of the day. Hannity tonight, 9 Eastern on the Fox News Channel. We got a good show for you. We'll get to that. And we also have, yeah. Oh, okay. Chuck Liddell is coming up next. The Iceman's coming back. This guy is, he defines all UFC, MMA fighting, and he's getting back in the ring on Saturday night. I actually spent a training session with him. He'll check in with us a few minutes. We'll also get to your calls, 800-941-SEAN, if you want to be a part of the program. Great Hannity tonight. Sarah Greg Dershowitz, we have a battle over the border. You saw what's happening. We've been playing it all day. Caravan now in Tijuana, and the people there are livid tonight at 9.
To introduce a man that needs no introduction. He has a record of 30-8, and it is my pleasure and honor to introduce to you Chuck Liddell. Chuck.
Thank you, everyone, for having me here. First, to address Tito, I know he's hoping. I know you're hoping. I'm a shell of the man that I was, because that's the only way he'd have a chance to beat me. But he's going to find out real quick, November 24th, that I'm not. I still hit just as hard. I still wrestle just as well, and he is going to get knocked out.
Fighting out of San Luis Obispo, California, Chuck the Iceman Liddell!
All right, there it is, the big announcement, a huge history. Chuck the Iceman Liddell making a massive comeback to the Octagon, MMA, 48 years of age. Chuck Liddell is the biggest name in MMA history by far, responsible really almost single-handedly for putting the UFC MMA on the map. And, of course, the rivalry between Chuck and Tito Ortiz is one of the most notable rivalries in the history of the sport. After 9 years of retirement, Chuck is getting back in the octagon, and he is coming back, he says, to teach Tito Ortiz, his younger rival, a lesson of the kind of fighter man champion that he should be. And this time he returns, you know, a pretty amazing comeback. Chuck Liddell and I actually had an opportunity once. I trained mixed martial arts. It's an eclectic blend of Krav Maga, Kempo, Jiu-Jitsu, boxing, street fighting, situational fighting, firearm defense training, and blades and sticks. And, you know, I still do it 5 days a week, about an hour and a half a day. I haven't stopped, Chuck. I'm getting bigger, stronger than I've ever been in my life. How are you, my friend?
I'm doing great. How are you? It's been a long time, man. How you been?
I'm good. So it was one of the great honors of my life when I got to train with you. And, I mean, you're 48 years old. You're making this comeback. How hard have you been training?
Oh, I've been training real hard. I mean, it's been a long road. You know, it started over a year ago. We got the idea of doing it, and been working on getting in shape ever since. And, you know, it was an interesting road, you know, a learning experience.
So this is going to be at the L.A. Forum. I was going to go until my plans changed. My daughter's schedule sadly conflicted with it, but I wanted to be ringside. Almost every time I buy an MMA fight, you know, you usually get them on demand. I think the last one I got was, did you watch Mayweather, by the way? And what's his name? Oh, my gosh.
Actually, I was in Peru, and we were watching it, trying to watch it. I got to see bits and pieces of it because it was going in and out of us.
Well, by the way, if McGregor's going to fight and you're taking every weapon out of his hand, how could he possibly win? I mean, I thought he did a good job hanging in there for 9 rounds, and he seemed to, you know, pucker out.
Well,
but
he did his best you could do for, I mean, if you're taking a guy that's never had a boxing match and putting him against one of the best defensive boxers of all time and expecting him to do miracles, you know, I thought he did a great job for what the situation he was put in. I mean, I think I still believe it would have been a lot more interesting if you let him meet in the middle. You know, it's not mixed martial arts, but it's not boxing. Make him have a fight kickboxing. Now that would be an interesting fight.
I think that would be probably perfect in the middle. I don't see Mayweather ever allowing that to happen. And, you know, it just takes – it took 95% of McGregor's tools out of his pocket. What did you think of McGregor's last fight when he lost in his comeback fight?
You know, I thought he actually did a great job of fighting. He would survive the first couple rounds. I thought that's what he needed to do. And then he had that third round. He had a chance to strike with him, but I think he didn't have enough left in the gas tank. He didn't have enough pop on his punches anymore to even have a chance.
Well, Khabib is also, I mean, he wore him out. I mean, almost, and to me, those are the boring fights. I don't like when grappling goes on for that long a period of time, and almost every round, Khabib is so good at it. I mean, you got to tip your hat to the guy. Got him on the ground, and they're fighting there. You know, there is an emergence, I think, to MMA fighting and what you've been involved in, UFC fighting, and that is bare knuckle fighting. But it was a really tough road to get athletic approval, even for states like New York. It was only recently that they allowed the matches to take place at Madison Square Garden. Most of them for a long time were just taking place out in Vegas. Do you ever see the day when bare knuckle brawling, no rules, no hold barred, ever comes and is legal?
You know, I don't see that happening, not anytime soon. I mean, they're allowing the bare knuckle fighting some places now, boxing. It is what it is. I mean, people will pay to see it. Someone's going to try to put it on, right? But I think it's going to stay. They're going to stay with the big states, the big commissions. They're going to want safety rules. There's not going to go back to no holds barred.
You know, did you find it harder? I mean, you were the defining face of the UFC and MMA octagon fighting for so long. And it's always good. Almost every single fight I watch, you're ringside. So you're still involved heavily in the sport.
Yeah, I love this sport. I'll be involved as long as people want to see me out there. I like being around. I like watching fights. I'm a big fan of the sport. So, yeah, I'm always going to be trying to promote the sport.
What did you think about Khabib flying out of the octagon and going after McGregor's guys?
You know, that was very disappointing. I mean, you know, I was really upset with the fact, because he's a good guy. I mean, he's you know,
he's a champion. He's a great fighter. He's tough.
And he's a great, he's kept his cool. But, you know, when you let guys get away with that stuff over and over again, all the craziness, and people get rewarded for going out there and being, you know, doing this crazy stuff, you know, it's hard to, you know, he snapped. I mean, he said it, I lost it, I shouldn't have done it, and, you know, I snapped. And, you know, I actually liked his after interview saying his dad was going to kick his butt when he got home, you know.
Yeah. That's funny. But all right, so you're going to be fighting at the LA Forum on Saturday night. It's on pay-per-view. I'm definitely going to be watching. I'm a huge fan, and you say you've been able to obtain the shape that you were in when you left the octagon 9 years ago.
Yeah, I've gotten in great shape. This camp went very well. I'm not beat up. I got through it healthy. And I'm in great condition. I'm in great shape, and you know I've been working at it for a long time. I came into camp right about the weight I wanted to be at, so I could eat regularly during camp. I've been on a diet for a long time. Made some great life choices, in the off season, and
it's gonna be big. All right, so it's taking place. We're going to be watching. It's this Saturday night. You can get it on pay-per-view, whatever your cable provider, or if you're like me, on Dish TV. You're going to love it. Chuck, great to talk to you, man. Listen, I'm pulling for you on Saturday. You're the guy. You're the man. And I enjoyed my one day of training with you. I show that video all the time, and I just put it up on Hannity.com if people want to go see it.
That's awesome. Hey, also, they can watch it on RingTV.com or FightTV.com, all your cable providers.
And your satellite providers. All right, got it. This Saturday night, Chuck Liddell's return to the Octagon. You don't want to miss it. 800-941-SEAN. Want to be a part of the program. Mara is in Juneau, Alaska. What's up, Mara? How are you?
Hi, Sean. It's an honor to talk to you.
Honor is all mine. What's going on?
So the day of the election, going back to that, I was on Facebook. And one of my friends who lives in New York City posted about how proud he was to have absentee voted a couple of weeks ago here in Juneau, even though he has lived in Brooklyn for as long as I've known him, which is over 10 years. So it's pretty brazen voter fraud right on Facebook, and he was actually proud of it, you know, hashtag blue wave. I was pretty outraged at how he nonchalantly did it, didn't really feel like there was anything wrong with his behavior, and it made me feel like it was probably a more widespread behavior than they would like us to think.
Understand. Look, people do this all the time, or if they have multiple homes, where do they decide to vote, register, etc.? It gets complicated because of tax law more than anything else. But you know, you have to be able to be the true resident of where you say you are. And people move back and forth a lot. It gets complicated. They're registered, but you only can vote in one place, not two. And all that's going to do is put that person in some type of legal jeopardy if they're out there not only doing it, but bragging about it, and they're not living there. Eventually, that can catch up to you. And if it does, you're going to regret breaking the law. Look, it's sort of like all these people that get in trouble with taxes. I'm like, let's say you can't, for whatever reason, you had an emergency and you can't pay your taxes. The worst thing to do is not file. You know, just file the amount that you owe and get one of these tax companies to go in there and work out a deal. Otherwise, you know, look, they understand that situations can arise. But if you try and hide it and you don't pay your taxes and file your taxes, you're going to get in trouble. You know, you can't lie on these loan applications. I mean, that's what got, you know, Manafort and all these other people in trouble. You can't do it. And if you do, you're risking your liberty and your freedom, and it's just not worth it. You know, I always assumed in the Obama years, every year I did taxes, always just assumed it was tough. I'm going to get audited. And then I get audited three times since Trump's been president. Nothing comes of it because I pay my taxes. If you do your job, follow the rules. I don't like a lot of these laws. They're oppressive. The amount of money New York charges me every year, it is beyond oppressive. And it just happens to be where I have to stay doing the jobs that I do. The second I can escape and pay less taxes, I'm leaving. You know, I love when my financial guy, goes, you need to get out. You can't die in New York. And I look at him every year when he says it. I'm like, okay, I'm really going to try and plan on that, because none of us plans the day that we die. I don't have a say in that. That's going to be up to somebody far bigger, more important, and powerful than I am. I'm just a speck of dust in this game here. So I recognize that as truth also. Thank you. Mario is next, Broward County. Mario, how are you? Glad you called.
Hey, Sean. Greetings from Deerfield Beach. Thank you for taking my call.
Yes, sir. Thank you.
Hey, I have really, I wouldn't say foolproof, but a very strong way to stop illegals from voting. What we have to do is we have to remove the voting rolls from the state and county databases, move it all into federal, and then purge all the dead voters, all the deceased people out of here. And then also, in order to get a voting card, let it get issued by the federal government, where they ask questions like how they do on the credit reports, that only the real person that's attached to that social security number knows things in their life, you know, like what street were they living on when they were a certain age. Also another hard thing that they would have to try and get over is these provisional ballots are garbage, to be truthfully, they are.
They become very important when you get to recount time. You got to remember that. Look, do I wish there was a universal system? You know, all these states, all these, that those that have early voting, those that don't have early voting, I'll give you one reason why you let people vote for a month. It just is problematic. Who's watching all those ballots for a month? Do you have people from both sides able to follow them from the time they arrive to the time they get counted and the time that they may get recounted? It just lends itself to potential corruption. The other thing is as early as you let people vote, well, what about that last minute surprise that might have changed your mind? You know, that becomes problematic when you let people vote that far in advance. I would have some federal guidelines. I don't think people should be voting more than a week ahead of time at the most. I think there are too many issues that can come up in a final week of a campaign that could change people's minds. Once you vote, you can't vote again. I think we have to have voter ID for sure. When you present a provisional ballot, if like Arizona is all going to be all mail-in ballots and you have to check every signature, and who makes the determination if it matches or it doesn't match? It makes it very, very hard. I don't know. Why can't we just make voting election day a national holiday? Let everybody go vote that wants to vote. Everyone wants to stay home can stay home. Make it simple. And if you're going to have machines that can't be in any way altered with. If you're going to do any type of balloting system where you have to fill in the ovals, you better fill in the oval the way it says, or that's it. And very specific instructions for everybody. All right, that's going to wrap things up for today. All right, we will have a busy Hannity tonight. We expect written answers by the president as it relates to Robert Mueller. We'll also have the list of the people that need to be investigated. News you won't get anywhere else. Good news, doesn't seem to be any subpoena fight about a president giving testimony before a grand jury. We have Chairman Nunes is going to join us, Sarah and Greg, Alan Dershowitz tonight. Also, now people in Tijuana, they are fed up. All right, that's all happening tonight, 9 Eastern, on the Fox News Channel. Hope you'll join us. See you tonight at 9, back here tomorrow.